Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf, and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. Matt Gutman can tell you the precise moment when his life was upended. Reporting live on a huge story in January 2020, he found himself in the throes of an on-air panic attack, and not for the first time. The truth is that Gutman had been enduring panic attacks in secret for 20 years, soul-bruising episodes that left his vision constricted, his body damp, his nerves shot. Despite the challenges he had carved out a formidable career, reporting from war zones and natural disasters before millions of viewers on Good Morning America, World News Tonight, and 2020. His nerves typically punched through to TV audiences, making his appearances kinetic and often unforgettable. But his January 2020 broadcast was unusual for all the wrong reasons. Mid-panic, Gutman misstated the facts of a story, a blunder that led to a month-long suspension, not to mention public shame and personal regret. It was a reckoning. Gutman's panic attacks had become too much for him to bear in secret, and he needed help. And today, we dive into this. Matt vulnerably shares what happened, how he managed it, what a panic attack is, and we discuss how, using tips and strategies and techniques, how we can make a panic attack work for us and not against us. So join me today. I am very, very excited about today's podcast. We have the amazing Matt Gutman with us, who is really well known to all of us, who's amazing, who's really one of the top reporters in the world, I believe, Matt, in terms of reporting live from, you know, disaster areas and things that are happening, and some of the top things that have happened in this time period. And, you know, I just want to honor the incredible work that you've done bringing what's going on in the world to us, right into our living rooms. And we appreciate that. And you have an amazing story to tell about how you looked so cool on the outside, but on the inside, there was this whole panic attack going on. And you've written a phenomenal book, No Time to Panic, and you've opened up about all kinds of things. And I am thrilled to be talking to you today, because there's just like a million things that I want to ask you and chat with you about. So welcome.
Thank you. And likewise, because I'm very eager to pick your brain and hear some of your answers about some things.
Oh, well, so that's great. That's going to be so much. Oh, no, well, thank you for joining us today. So Matt, tell us a little bit about your background. Everyone, you know, most people know you, but it's just fascinating just what you did and how you got to end up writing this book.
I've been a journalist for almost 25 years, and I have been fascinated with that nice space where life is closest to death. And the reason for that is because I guess I craved the intensity, but also it felt like the most authentic. And so one of the things I realized that my day-to-day comprised meeting people on what is typically their worst day. And I suffered some trauma when I was a child. I mean, many of us have. My father was killed when I was young in a plane crash. It was sudden. It was terrible. Mm. But it armed me this superpower. Right? Like, I realized quite young that I was able to communicate people in our shared language of grief. So like, they may be in Haiti or Gaza or Afghanistan or China or Russia, but I could communicate people even if I couldn't speak the language, because there is this sort of shared experience and shared language of people who've been through something. When I was able to give of myself and commiserate and show sympathy and empathy, and that was sort of, I learned the superpower, this communicative skill. And so I don't know if that is what pointed me in the direction of being a conflict reporter, or I don't know what it is, but that's what I ended up doing and have been doing for basically my whole career in print and radio, TV. I'm also a dad and a husband and have two dogs.
Those are very important parts of it all as well. So I'm so glad you had the dogs and cats on. Both of us were chasing our dogs out of our studios before we started this, which was really funny. Well, you know, if anyone just has to watch how you know, just some of your footage of your reporting, they'll just see someone who's so engaged. And now that you've explained it like that, and I've heard you so many times, but the way you explained it now, that you could relate to people in that gap between life and death, and it's such, you know, how you could empathize. That's very evident in your reporting, and so evident in your competence and how you stand in front of the camera and so together. So that your secret behind all of this, that there was a whole, you looked amazing in front of the camera. You did a phenomenal job. You loved and connected with the people. And as you said in your own words, and I'm repeating what I've read and heard and seen you do, is you really loved reporting in that moment. But as soon as you had to stand in front of the camera and a few sentences into 24 seconds or 40 seconds, and that was the pressure that changed and shifted. And you had been living with a secret. Can you talk about that, Matt? That really led to your book.
I love the fact that you've actually read the book. So I do a lot of these podcasts. Not everybody has read the book. And so
exactly.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And listeners know that this is someone who does the homework. She's not just here to do the interview. She's actually reading the stuff and doing the research. So thank you. I appreciate
my
that.
Pleasure.
So yeah, like one of my other gifts is energy, right? Like I have a lot of energy. I'm super kinetic. And when I just first started doing TV, people said I really punched through. But one of the reasons, so like I do have a high baseline of energy and like I'm constantly going. But one of the things that gave me that real spike of energy and made me punch through was the fact that almost every time I went on camera, I would have a panic attack just before or during. And so a panic attack, I describe it as the orgasm of anxiety. If an orgasm is the maximal expression of pleasure, then a panic attack is the maximal expression of anxiety. So it's like everything bubbling out of you at once. And so if you've had one, it's pretty much unforgettable. And I was having them regularly, but instead of causing my brain to freeze, which it would do, but just for a short time, I don't know what it did, but it made me punch through. And so people kept saying, Matt, you're so great live. We only want you live. For 20 years, I couldn't tell people the dark secret, which is I hated going live because I basically sweat through my underwear.
Dying. Pain.
Yeah. I would tremble. These are the symptoms of a panic. Shortness of breath. Mm-hmm. My chest feel like it's collapsing. My heart felt like it was punching through my chest. I would have feelings of derealization, loss of control. It was terrifying and really painful.
Terrifying.
And yet I did it again and again and again until I made a cataclysmic mistake on air for the first time on one of the biggest stories I ever did, which led to my suspension. I was covering the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash, which is literally 10 miles from where I live. Mm-hmm. And normally I travel all over the world, but this big story happened almost in my backyard.
On your doorstep.
Right.
And paralleled your own life experience, didn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. So Kobe Bryant was the same age as my father when my father was in a small plane crash. And I was basically the same age as Gianna, his daughter, who died. And I don't want to get into the mistake I made out of respect to the family. But I made a mistake live on air reporting because I was in the middle of a panic attack. And I mixed up two pieces of information. So one of the things that happens when you're panicking is your brain is primed for a threat. It's saying, you're under threat, Matt. I'm going to protect you because I'm your brain. And I'm going to harness all of these forces that you have to prevent the lion from eating you. The brain doesn't know, hey, I'm not worried about the lion. I've got to go on air right now. So it pumps all this adrenaline to your body. Your extremities are full with oxygen-rich blood because you're breathing so heavily. You are ready to sprint. You've got adrenaline flowing. So if the lion takes a bite out of your butt, you're going to be able to keep running. But it's not so good at remembering anything, long-term memory, which is anything over 30 seconds. And it's not so good at like doing basic reporting. It's really good at running. It's hard to tell your brain, hey, stop panicking. I need to focus. So I made this terrible, terrible mistake for which I was suspended for a month. And during that time, I basically had to figure out what I was going to do. My wife and I talked about leaving TV news. I would still be a journalist because that's all I know how to do. But maybe this is not for me. Yes, I happen to be really good at certain aspects of it and really like my job, but some of it also terrified me. And my wife was super just understanding and sympathetic. And she said, if this is not working, we'll figure it out. We'll take the pay cut and do something else. And we decided, I'm actually going to focus on dealing with the panic and maybe what lies beneath it. Maybe there's something else going on, and the panic is just a symptom of something bigger at play. And that the next that part took 3 years, basically, the figuring it out.
I'm so excited to share with you guys an incredible scientific breakthrough in the world of healthy aging and longevity. C15 is the first essential fatty acid to be discovered in 90 years. And get this, studies have confirmed that it is 3 times better, broader, and safer than omega-3. Fatty 15 co-founder Dr. Stephanie Van Watson discovered C15, the first essential fatty acid to be discovered in 90 years, while working with the U.S. Navy to improve the health and welfare of dolphins in San Diego, helping them to live longer with less chronic illness. Indeed, Fatty 15 is the world's first pure science-backed C15 supplement designed to support healthy aging and long-term wellness. It has 3 times the healthy aging cell benefits of omega-3 or fish oil. It's also made from a patented oxidation-resistant form of pure C15 derived from plants, which means it's vegan-friendly, free of flavors, fillers, allergens, or preservatives. And C15 is the only ingredient in Fatty 15. It's 100% pure. C15 works in multiple ways. It repairs age-related damage to cells, protects them from future breakdown, boosts mitochondrial energy output, and activates pathways in the body that help regulate our sleep, mood, and natural repair mechanisms for healthier aging overall. This functionality leads to a myriad of exciting benefits now as we age, namely improved metabolic, liver, and heart health, smoother functioning joints, deeper sleep, and healthier hair, skin, and nails. Fatty 15 is on a mission to replenish your C15 levels and restore your long-term health. You can now get an additional 15% off their 90-day subscription starter kit by going to fatty15.com/Dr. Leaf and using the code Dr. Leaf at checkout for an additional 15% off your first order. That's fatty15.com/Dr. Leaf and using the code Dr. Leaf at checkout for an additional 15% off. The link and details will be in the show notes. Wow. Thank you for sharing that and being so vulnerable. And, you know, it just helps, you know, I've listened to so many of your interviews as well. And just that being able to admit that. And I can see in your face and I can just hear in your body language and I'm seeing your body language. And just from watching you over time, how this being writing this book and talking about this has been such a release for you. And one of the key things that I know from the work I've done as a therapist and as a scientist is that we, as humans, we're really good at developing a coping mechanism of suppression to help us through the moment. And you became a master. I mean, you got your PhD in suppressing that lion biting your butt and, you know, like standing in front of that camera. And you learned to channel that energy of the panic attack into being an incredibly successful reporter. But eventually, over time, it wore away. And the explosion happened where you actually didn't remember stuff in that, at that incident that you mentioned. I think it was 2020, wasn't it? When the Kobe Bryant thing happened. Right. And that then, instead of running from that, you actually ran to it. So it's very admirable. I love that because the only way through is to process and to deal with it and to face it. But now I'm going to now throw something out at you and then you can take us on a journey because you are such a great storyteller. And what you're reading everything, listening to everything you said and knowing what I know about my field and You said things like, that's cool. My audience needs to hear it. So I'm going to say it, then you're going to say it 10 times better than me because it's your own internal experience. Okay. You said you tried everything for 3 years. You tried everything. You did all the every therapy. You did the cognitive behavior therapy. You did the biomedical model, the pharmaceutical model. You did the ayahuasca. You've done the, even that venom in your toes that made you like freak out. You even did the, you know, did the Reiki, which had such a massive impact on you and other people, we weren't responding to the ayahuasca, but you were, no, the, yeah, I think it was a psilocybin or one of them. And then you responded
so
to the Reiki.
You really did the research. Yes.
I know what you did. Okay. So then you and Eddie took you through, who's a common friend of ours. He took you through and he's been on this podcast, by the way, as well, to the holotropic breath work. And that really opened up something. And I say all this to say that you said what really the healing came when you recognized that you had never dealt with the well. And I'm holding my hand like this because you said it so beautifully. The well of grief of losing your dad, because you, after 12 years of age, when you lost your dad, from there, you went on to being a top academic, a top sportsman. You were just like Superman, everything, everywhere. But it was your way of suppressing. And eventually that, because experiences are real, and eventually the volcano exploded. Okay, I'm handing over to you.
No, I think you just raised something really interesting. We learn these coping mechanisms. I'm writing notes, everybody. We learn these coping mechanisms.
I think you're going to interview me. Your journalism's coming in here.
This is a work in progress. I'm still working on this. Some people didn't love this about the book, but like, I don't have all of the answers. I don't know if anybody does. I certainly didn't find them for me. I found some answers, some modalities that work. And I think so you're touching on one. But you also mentioned something really interesting, which is like, I learned at a young age how to do that coping well, right? I learned how to mask. I learned how to bury. I learned how to push away. And I got a PhD in it, as you just said. But so the question to you is, does it eventually catch up with all of us? Is it even possible to continue to outrun that nagging pain, the well of grief at the core?
No. And you said, no, you don't. It'll always be there. And that's what you said this as well in your experience that you had. You commented in, I think it was one of your interviews, and you said it in your book, that you realized that that grief was never going to go away, but that you'd had to, I'm paraphrasing, learn to manage it. So that's exactly when you've had an experience, because it's our mind, brain, and body are separate. So as you have an experience, your mind is processing that, and then it puts it into the brain and into every cell of your body. And that's how we have that whole embodied, embrained experience and how it affects us and so on. But whatever's happened to you is there forever. But what we do is we change what it looks like inside of us. So to answer your question more directly, does that well of grief ever go away? Can we keep suppressing? No, we can't, because that experience is real. It's dynamic. It's alive. It's growing in your brain. It's changing, but it's growing in your body. It's not a brain down effect. It's brain and body, but mind, three things. And those three, it's a network. And that network will always, your story will always be with you. But what we can do is change what it looks like inside of us. If we constantly cope in the moment, like you did in the moment as a 12-year-old, but then you went through life and that coping mechanism wasn't sustainable and it exploded. So if you think of it like that experience was like a volcano and it kept bubbling and bubbling and bubbling, and eventually in 2020, whenever that date was, the volcano exploded. And you had two options. You either were going to just get burnt under the lava, or you let the lava cool down and it remineralized the soil and you grew this whole new garden, which is what minerals do, and all this new healthy stuff, and you produced this, and now you're helping people. So there we go. There's your story in a nutshell.
I love the volcano analogy. So my analogy been the well of grief, right? And my fear, I didn't cope, and the reason I was able to sort of cover my pain and move on was because I became good at it. But then it became so great that I didn't want to go in there. And so I would call it this well of grief. And my fear was that I would fall into this well. I would tumble so deep that I couldn't climb my way out. And I was afraid of I knew the pain lurked inside, but I was afraid of dealing with it. I didn't want to go in there and start crying for years, because maybe it would be irrevocable. Maybe I wouldn't be able to stop the grief, stop the sadness. Mm-hmm. And so the only way was to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And so the reason my methods in the book worked for me, even though they were unorthodox and possibly not even well planned out, because I wasn't planning on writing a book, Dr. Leap. I was just trying to fix me. Like, this was not done for other people at first. Like, I wasn't thinking about anybody else. I'm like, I'm broken. I need to find a way to fix me, and I need to do it soon or my whole life is going to collapse, and can't deal with that. I have kids. I have a career. I have my wife. Like, this is not working. I need to fix it. And so the concept of that well of grief was that I found a way. I couldn't go into the well of grief. I couldn't allow myself to go to that deep, dark place because it was too scary. So I couldn't do it in my right mind. I had to get out of my right mind, which is literally like, that's why holotropic breath work, which you are almost essentially like having a psychedelic experience, which is why psychedelics work for me, which is why this crazy Reiki experience, which I don't believe in Reiki. I don't believe in astrology or psychics, but something worked. I don't know what it is, but it worked. Launched me into this, you know, I don't know what you would call it, but this, you know, escapade of constant crying. Mm-hmm. Like, I was able to empty out this well of grief, bailing it tier by tier, you know, that eventually made me feel better. Like, it's still there, but it's not as scary as it was. And the other major takeaway, and you know this scientifically, we know that physically crying from sadness or happiness releases these wonderful feel-good hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this free therapy. And I learned to be afraid of crying. And what ended up happening, if you read the book, it's like everything I start doing, I start crying and constantly crying in the book. But I learned not to be afraid of that. And I learned not to be afraid of the vulnerability of crying. And, you know, so just to come full circle, I was promoting the book, which had just come out on October 7th when Hamas began that rampage into Israel. And I immediately threw my whole plans out the window. And I was in Israel within 24 hours and on the Gaza border.
Wow.
And I basically sacrificed the promotion of the book because this is what I do.
Yeah.
And war had broken out. And it was really hard, just like seeing all, you know, like dead bodies and walking through bloodied scenes. And then just there was so much pain on both sides. And normally I would have just completely blocked it out. But towards the end of my first 3 weeks there, I started crying. Like when I hugged someone, I went to a park bench somewhere and just like gave myself 5 minutes to cry, to sob, because there was so much pain. And I had this new gift of being able to empty it in a way that worked for me. Maybe crying doesn't work for everybody, but it helped me. And so I was like, on the one hand, it was a little embarrassing to like go sit on a public park bench and be like, on the other hand, I don't care. And I felt proud of myself that I was able to find these new modalities of crying and sobbing without actually having to take a psychedelic or do breath work. I was able to get to that pain in my right mind and not having to put myself out of my right mind to find some healing. So like, it was hard and sad. On the other hand, I felt like, hey, that's successful. That's a pretty big difference, a pretty big space, a pretty big distance that I've covered in the 3 years since the Kobe Bryant mistake that I made, almost 4 years. Yeah.
Wow. You know, you speak about a pathway to empowerment, basically, of being able to self-manage and self-regulate and recognize that that's true healing, that you didn't need something outside to get you to the place. You actually had worked out what it was inside of you. And we've all got these wells of wisdom, to use your, you know, your analogy. And we've got you spoke about getting through the, you didn't say messy mind, but this podcast called Can You Prevent the Mess? I talk a lot about the messy mind, and we all live in the messy mind, and it's totally normal, but we have a wise mind. And as we go through this pathway to empowerment with all the healing, you learn to tap in through the messy mind into the wise mind, and your ability to cry as you is describing that to me. That's so moving. Thank you for sharing that about, you know, being there and, you know, sacrificing, as you said, your book launch to go and do something so much more. You know, this is not that this is important, but that was a life thing that you could report on. But again, I got the visual of a well, and then this endless well, but with all these little tap areas. And it's so as you cry, you're opening the tap and letting it come out. So instead of it, you keep the pressure equal, as opposed to, so we're always going to have, so we've got unlimited empathy. And when you are healed, like you're going through this process of healing, you're using that in the right way. In the past, you would have kept it inside, that would have exploded or, you know, created a tsunami inside of you, whereas you actually let it come out. So you constantly kept the pressure. And then that helps you to relate to the people. So I want to ask you, was your experience, obviously it was, but in your words, that experience of you always did connect well with people. Was it different now that you were able to just sit on that park bench and cry? How did people respond? How did you feel? What was the experience that was different?
I did a couple of park benches. You know, it was interesting. I love that. We have unlimited empathy. And
unlimited.
Well, there are two things. First, I mean, this is something that you mentioned in your podcast, which is learning the signals, right? Like I was better able to pick up the signal that I was in distress. I was in emotional distress, you know, weeks after the war, is also fatigued, and I needed an outlet. And the outlet that has worked for me lately is having empathy and also expressing how I
feel.
And so what was happening is that I was hugging people, and I would start crying, and they would cry too. Mm-hmm. Like it would give them
a release.
Know, the right. Yeah. And so like people were completely mirroring my, mm-hmm. my experience. And there was a lot of that crying and sadness going on in general, just because it was obvious that this was the start of something
terrible,
extremely bad and extremely traumatic. And what it was so fascinating to see people who were hardened, like the security expert who was our bodyguard, that guy was able to cry with me, you know?
Oh, wow.
Even people you wouldn't expect who would be able to reflect that kind of sympathy and empathy and pain, actually able to do so if you take your, you know, remove some of the armor that we have built to protect us from that pain. So it was a really interesting experience, and one that ultimately helped me do my job and be a better father and husband when I came back, because I was less damaged than I might be otherwise.
You know, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And one of the things that you mentioned, you may not, I'm paraphrasing again, but you mentioned it in your book and interviews, is that you had come to accept that you weren't ever going to get rid of the panic attacks, but you had learned how to manage them and recognize where they came from and recognize the source, which was the grief of losing your father, not really ever dealing with that and the shock and the trauma. And then layers upon layers of, you know, you just described walking through, you know, bloodied bodies and just, you know, this is obviously viewers and listeners and things. This is a reality of what you do every day of your life, just about when you are reporting. That's layers of trauma, you know, secondary trauma that you're experiencing on top of the other, on top of the, and so what I'm hearing you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that on top of the initial trauma of your dad dying, then going into what you did, and then your high school when you were, you know, you had to do your presentation and you're in your turtleneck and all that stuff. And then it went into your reporting days. Each thing, you know, that was building. And at the same time, you were adding other layers of what you were experiencing. It sounds to me like you weren't for a time processing all the extra trauma. So kind of all of it just built up and eventually there was a major eruption in your life. So is that what happened? And what have you learned? If that is, what have you learned? And what did you, you know, what could you advise someone who's maybe experiencing repeated traumas or can relate to the experience in some way to what you've had?
So yes, one of the things that my career is about is adding layers of trauma. And one of the things that I've struggled with for years is that I was essentially kidnapped by the Venezuelan secret police in the end of 2016. Ooh. And it was 5 days. It wasn't very long. But during that period, they accused me of being a spy and they
threatened
to basically throw me and this producer who I was with away for years. So the producer I was with was freaking out because he was Venezuelan. He's like, you're going to be okay. And maybe only be a couple of years, but like, you're going to throw me away for 10 or 20. It was like, really, I had to memorize his lawyer's name, his mother's name, their phone numbers, his like social security number. He was afraid he was going to be disappeared. And I was afraid that I was going to be, you know, in some dungeon in their secret police building for years.
My gosh.
It was really, really scary.
Terrifying.
And we were held right near the dungeon. And it's just that. The fear of complete loss of agency and control. And so that was definitely like, in addition to talking to people who've experienced the most horrific things and absorbing their secondary trauma, I've had all these experiences that have added to it. And I didn't do enough sloughing off, right? So I only let it build instead of doing stuff that would remove it and help myself. I just didn't know how. Very well. I didn't even know that I had panic attacks for years. I called them nerves, right? In the book, I talk about going through almost 15 years of panic attacks without actually naming it. I mean, and I'm someone who has done therapy for many years and I was so closed off about panic and I was so ashamed of it because there is so much shame that's associated with it that I even wrote about it cryptically in my journals and these like weird hieroglyphics. That only I would understand. Like I'm writing in my own journals and I'm hiding it from myself. Like demented, right? But it gives you a sense of the amount of shame that was associated with it.
Sad.
Mm-hmm. And so it took this colossal disaster, this terrible mistake and a suspension to have a reckoning to basically shake me out of this really unhealthy way that I had been trying to deal with the pain that one accumulates. And you don't have to be a conflict reporter to accumulate trauma and pain and suffering.
No.
Right? Like normal life does plenty
exactly.
of that.
Exactly. It just does it too. Yeah. It's inevitable.
Right. Mine just happened. My reckoning just happened to be extraordinarily public, you know, watched by many millions of people. So that's, you know, most of us have it in quiet or in some sort of perhaps hopefully intimate setting. That was not so. For me, it was public. My suspension was public. I was ridiculed online. People were calling for my ouster and me being fired and I should never be a journalist again. And I totally understand why people were upset. But, you know, I did a lot of work on trying to fix it. And I'm grateful actually that ABC gave me the opportunity to stick around to do it. And they were
That's amazing.
Yeah, they were supportive of the endeavor. Once I told them, but Dr. Leaf, like, I never told anybody at ABC. I thought that they would cut me loose. And when I finally told my manager, she's like, oh, okay. I understand. Like, I have panic attack. Full on. She's like, okay. I'm glad you're dealing with it. I'm like, no. I wanted her to be more sympathetic, but she was like, yeah, I get it. I totally understand. That's okay. Well, we got you. So, sorry, I'll redo that.
Please.
So ultimately, my work was really supportive of the effort that I made to try to get to the end of panic.
That's fantastic. And you two things. What did you do to get over that initial? Cause that was another trauma, another major trauma, your work, your life, who you were. Cause your work from the sounds of things, your work is not what you do. It's who you are. And, you know, it's even though you don't like being in front of the camera, you actually kind of, that was maybe you do. Maybe the panic attack was just blocking you from actually being, cause you're brilliant in front of the camera, you know? And so so that was another major trauma that was actually an awakening kind of sort of situation. How did you get through that time period? Because I know that there are people listening now, and I know I've had experiences where just like the worst thing that could possibly happen to you happens. And how did you do it? That's what I want to know. And I mean, I know because I've read your book and I've heard you talk, but I believe my listeners would benefit tremendously from how you did that. And then I want to talk about the workplace and mental health and that sort of thing.
You know, one of the things they teach in cognitive behavioral therapy is that the thing you fear most, the thing that often triggers the panic, is just not going to, it's very unlikely for it to happen. So people go to cognitive behavioral therapists and, you know, with fears of flying. The chances, the concept of flying is crazy scary, right? You're flying, you're 7 miles in the air in an aluminum tube packed with 200, 300 other people. Moving at 500 miles an hour. It's insane.
It's crazy. Right. It's crazy. Yeah.
But statistically, you're probably going to die. Same thing with people who have fears of spiders or snakes or even car wrecks, although, because that doesn't make total sense because most of us at our age are likely to die of a car wreck, if not from disease. But that's what cognitive behavioral therapy, at least the psychoeducational part, tries to teach you. Don't worry about that stuff because it's likely not going to happen. But my plane crashed like more than once. And the thing I feared most, which was losing control on air and
happened.
Yeah. Making a mistake live literally happened. And so it was a really tough thing to deal with. Obviously the fallout because of Kobe Bryant's family, because like I hadn't been there. The last thing I would ever want to do is cause, I don't even know if they knew about it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But like the thought of causing family. Who had been through this horrific experience, even a second of additional harm was just brutal to me. And then obviously the harm I did myself and my career and my coworkers, you know, like it wasn't a good thing. And so like there was a lot of like tearing of the clothes, not physically, but a lot of like mental beating oneself up. And then I basically had been thinking about doing a project about a sled dog family, a family that breeds sled dogs in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, well, my schedule has opened up. Maybe I'll go up to Alaska in the middle of February and visit them. And they kindly welcomed me, and I got to work with the sled dogs for several days. And then on the way back,
Such an experience. I just want to interrupt you. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Relationships are tough, but they make life worth it. We are made for community, but sometimes navigating that community can be a challenge. A common misconception about relationships is that they have to be easy to be right. Sometimes the best ones happen when both people put in the work to make them great. Whether we are talking about romantic partnerships, friendships, family members, or co-workers. And therapy can be a place to work through the challenges you face in all of your relationships, whether it is with friends, work, your significant other, or anyone. Indeed, talk therapy is for so much more than working through a past trauma or current problem. It can also help us learn to thrive in every area of our lives, including our relationships. It is not just for when something is going wrong, but also for those times we feel we can learn to grow in specific areas of our lives. I personally have found that talking to someone I trust so helpful when it comes to family dynamics. The outside perspective helped me gain more insight and wisdom into what to do to improve my own relationships and manage delicate situations. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/Dr. Leaf today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Dr. Leaf. The link and details will be in the show notes. Such an experience. I've been over in Quebec. We did some sled with the dogs, and oh my gosh, what an experience. Anyway, I relate. So I was smiling there because I've had the experience. So that's fascinating.
And I was the custodian. So I was cleaning up the poop and the pee in their, around their dog houses. That was what I did for 3 days, which is great because they're really grateful. Right. And there's nothing quite so satisfying as freeing a little frozen hockey puck of pee. It's actually, once you get the hang of it, it's fun. And the dogs are just like licking you and they're all, it was actually amazing. It was the best therapy. And then on the way back to the airport, I was flying out of Anchorage and I decided to drive from Fairbanks, where I was, the 6 or 7, I don't know, 8 hours, whatever it is, to Anchorage. And this long, lonely ribbon of highway that's snowblown, middle of February. And on the way is Denali. And, you know, this beautiful national park. And so there are a couple of like smaller hills of Denali. And I don't know, I'm just going to go hike this thing. And it's only, you know, it's 5,000-6,000 feet. It's not like a crazy big mountain. And so I hop
in
off
the snow,
trail
in the snow
in the middle of February. And so I get out of my car, but I'm like in decent shape, you know, and I start chugging up the hill and I have a little bottle of water and protein bar. I'm good to go. Then the trail disappeared. I see the top of the mountains. I don't need a trail. I'm just going to bushwhack. So I bushwhack.
Oh my gosh.
And I see the most incredible vista, like straight out of a Jack London book, right? Rivers and meadows and valleys and these cathedrals of mountains on either side. You just can't imagine it. And I am drunk on nature. Just, I'm like, it's such a different kind of high and I'm reveling it. In it. And I also realized, like, you know, it's afternoon. It's getting dark. I should probably make my way down. And so I can't find the way I came up exactly. And it's also too steep to go down. So I thought I'd sort of spiral down. The snow starts to get deeper and deeper because there is no trail. And then I start doing this tumbling thing to get through the snow, which is fun. So I'm like doing forward flips, just get down the hill. And then the snow gets too deep to do that. And then the snow gets deeper. And then the snow is above my head. And now I realize, stuck, getting dark. And I have no cell phone signal. And I can't get out. This is like cold quicksand.
And then
I start to feel that again. My heart's going, shortness of breath. I'm like, I'm having a panic attack. But what I understood is that
brain starts freezing.
But this is when you're supposed to have a panic attack. And your brain is figuring something out. And one of the great things about having panic attack, about having the stress response, is that it activates your brain's GPS. And so I don't know how I had gone down the other side of a mountain. It was completely like I'd never been there before. I had no cell signal, but I knew exactly how to find the trail. Right. And so I took a breath. I composed myself and I thought, how am I going to get out of here? Who goes on the snow? And I was like, well, you know, I saw these horseshoe hares or snowshoe hares before, and they kind of go on top of the snow. Okay. Snowshoe. Okay. So like, I'm going to make myself into a human snowshoe. And so like I swam to the next tree and it's literally the snow is so deep. I'm at the top, the crown of the tree. I start snapping off branches of this tree and stuffing them in my pants, in my jacket, in my sleeves, in my feet, in my boots. And then I like make a human snow angel to start getting out of the super deep snow. And an hour later, I crawl back on the trail, completely soaked in sweat and also like super grateful. And I realized that yes, panic is really not so great for us, but the human stress response is the human stress response for a reason, because it works, can be a superpower when you harness it the right way. And my body did exactly what it was supposed to at exactly the right time. And it was the very dawn of this kernel of an idea that I started to have, which is, okay, maybe I'm not fatally broken. Maybe I'm not so broken that I'm irredeemable. And that led me for the next year to this, like this evolutionary psychology obsession that I had. Cause the central question, Dr. Lee, was like, I'm broken. Aren't I broken? Like if I have panic attacks at the wrong time, I must be broken. Like that, what's the point? Like how have humans evolved to continue to have panic attacks when they're so cataclysmically bad for us? And eventually, and you know this through your work, is that, well, you know, humans have panic attacks still tens of thousands of generations later, because it's just part of who we are, because fear was really adaptive and humans were really good at being afraid, which helped us do better planning and thinking ahead and helped us avoid the lion that was going to eat the other animal, but we could get away from the lion sooner and smarter. So I did a whole recalibration, to make a long story short, through evolutionary psychology about why I am the way I am. And I learned that panic is normal. Your brain is wired to have 1,000 false alarms, which is a panic attack, so long as it doesn't have a single missed alarm. You miss an alarm and you're dead. A panic attack, well, that's just 50 burned calories. Your body can handle that. And this was sort of the start of me starting to forgive myself and realizing that I'm not broken, that I'm not a complete failure.
That is so amazing. That story, the conclusion you came to, because that is so true. And it's one of the key things in anything. It's our whole mind, brain and body is wired for love. And just a little secret, or maybe you've heard me say this before, but that our brain telling us what to do, our brain can't tell us anything. It's actually your mind, your non-conscious, in your non-conscious mind, which is the most intelligent part of you, which is directing the brain and the body, and the brain and the body are wired for love. So everything about, just this term we use in science, and essentially everything about you is for survival. So when you describe the GPS and turn yourself into a human snowshoe and, you know, that the panic and you're not broken, thank you for saying that, because that is exactly, we have all these response. We need the anxiety. We need the depression. These are not illnesses to be suppressed. That's what we've been fighting the system for 38 years in my work, is that these are not things to be, these are things to be managed. And when you manage them, look what happens. Look at your life. Look at how you transform out of being sunk in the snow, which is really an analogy for your life, to getting on top of the snow and moving through and getting out and, you know, recognizing you're not broken. So thank you for saying that, because I say so often on this podcast that it's not the way you show up in those signals is not who you are. It's you showing up that way because of something. And if you embrace that panic attack and find the information, you're going to shift. And you did that. You've done that. You're doing that. And you will be doing that for the rest of your life. So you're not trying to eliminate. So you said at the beginning, you're not going to give, and some people may be disappointed, you're not going to give the solution to get rid of panic attacks forever. That's not what you want to do. what you want to do is use them to your advantage. And that seems to be what you've learned to do, precisely, which is so powerful.
I don't have the full on pit. And once you start to embrace it and accept it, you don't really have the same types of panic attacks. Although I'm sure if like, you know, I do get the same stress response. If I break short, there's a traffic accident in front of me, I get that jolt of adrenaline, but I don't get the same thing on TV because I know these basic things that you just talked about. I'm not broken. These are features, right? And I love the fact that you got that whole concept that these are adaptive traits, right? Like our heart beats fast so we can get oxygen and blood to our bodies so we can run faster. One of the reasons that we get tunnel vision when we have a panic attack is because humans used to be attacked most vulnerable at night. So our pupils expand to bring in more light. That made sense to me. I was like, okay, we're sweaty, possibly to make us more slippery to predators. So all these things were really interesting features that I learned about. And as long as I learned that I am not a broken failure mess and that these are features that I can, as you say, manage or try to harness even, I was like, okay, great. And then the next step was talking about it, bringing other people in, not being ashamed of it. And this is actually more than a year or change into the process of figuring me out that I realized that I actually think I need to write a book about it, because I tried to find, before I told anybody at work, because I was still not there yet, even over a year into realizing, okay, I'm not broken. This could be a feature. Panic is normal, all this stuff. I still wasn't ready to tell colleagues or my bosses at work. So I tried to find a panic attack support group. And this was in the midst of the pandemic. And I couldn't find one. So I called the anxiety and the AADA, the American Anxiety and Depression Association. And I called all of these sort of depression and anxiety organizations that are nationwide that should have all the resources to help us figure out how to find a panic attack and a panic attack support group. So there are anxiety groups. There are all sorts of, I think there's 17,000 AA groups in America. And at the end of the day, I was only able, with the help of all of these national groups, find 5 panic attack groups in the country. 3 of them were defunct because the pandemic killed them. And so there were 2. I joined one, which was so happy with people that it took 45 minutes just to get through the hellos. Again, it was like a big deal for me.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
To be able to say, Dr. Leaf, hi, I'm Matt Gutman. I'm a TV correspondent who's afraid of going on TV. Oh. But like, that's all it took. But there were so many people. And I realized, wow, people who suffer panic attacks, and many of them can be agoraphobic, they are so underserved and underrecognized. Like, who's there for these people? And so we started these offshoot groups on WhatsApp chains for the people who couldn't even get a word in edgewise in the groups. And that's when I decided, all right, I think I can help people if I write a book. There are all these people, anywhere from 28, 30% to 50% of Americans will experience a panic attack in their lifetime. Yeah. And nobody's talking
about
this.
And that's probably more. A lot more than that, because it's such a, because people is different, as you know, varying degrees of panic attacks. And, and as you said, people don't talk about it. They're not, you know, I work with a lot of physicians and people that are professionals. And as you've just said yourself, you were scared to tell your bosses because they would have, you know, like,
exactly. They would have
put you, these physicians, these nurses, these people all over the world in every profession. And even if they're not in profession, that are panicking. And if we know how to redirect that energy and direct it, it's actually something that can be so helpful to us as humans. So, you know, this is really important work that you're doing. Fascinating about the groups. I didn't realize that.
Oh, I was shocked. I was shocked. And I had them go over the numbers again, and I had them keep looking, and they couldn't find it. I mean, okay, so people have a panic attack, but it happens alone, and there's no real drain or stress on society or the system. It's because people go internal when they have a panic attack.
Yeah, until they collapse.
Unlike, you know, people who are struggling with alcohol, it's something that can be violent. and damaging to their family and their community. But people don't realize how much of an effect panic does have on our society and how much of a drain it is.
Yeah.
And that's because more than 30% of all the people who check into the hospital complaining of cardiac trouble, thinking they're having a heart attack, are having a panic attack. And 50% are either having a panic attack or anxiety-related trouble, which costs our system many billions of dollars a year. Because people are like me. I was one. I never went to the hospital because I've been way too ashamed. I would rather have died in my bedroom than admit I had a panic attack at that point. But so many people think that they're dying. In fact, they're having a panic attack because we have so little awareness of the symptoms and what it's like. And that, you know, for many people,
how to utilize it.
Exactly.
There's always a lot of things to do on my to-do list, but finding the will to do what I need to do can be incredibly challenging at times, especially when my mind feels foggy and overwhelmed and I know I'm not alone. What if there was a way we could increase our willpower, transforming our life habits for the better, from workouts to job performance to life goals? Well, our sponsor NeuroHacker combines 28 of the most research-backed nootropic ingredients on earth into the ultimate brain fuel formula, Qualia Mind. And it's been changing people's lives for years now. The formula is non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, and the ingredients are meant to complement one another, factoring each ingredient's effect on supporting mental clarity. It's also backed by a 100-day money-back guarantee, so you have almost 3 months to try Qualia Mind at no financial risk and decide for yourself. Since I've started taking Qualia Mind, I feel more focused, have more energy to do what I need to do, and have more mental clarity. It's truly an amazing product. See what the best brain fuel formula on earth can do for your mindset. Go to neurohacker.com/Dr. Lee for up to $100 off Qualia Mind. And as a listener of Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess, use the code Dr. Leaf at checkout for an additional 15% off any purchase. That's neurohacker.com/Dr. Leaf and use the code Dr. Leaf for an additional 15% off to experience life-changing mental performance from Qualia Mind. The link and details will be in the show notes. Matt, I can't tell you how much this is helping people, and just, you know, hearing you say these things, and, you know, even with all of us paddle with panic in different levels, as you've just described and we've been talking. I mean, even myself, I've had experiences, but I've learned I'm lucky, I'm in the field. So I've actually learned to take the principles that I use. And when I can feel a panic attack coming on, I've learned how to redirect that. So it actually gets channeled into something that becomes constructive. But that's been a lot of hard work, and that's why I've actually got systems and apps and everything like that to help people. But what you've done with your book and your life story is absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's just, I could talk to you for hours. So we're going to have to be going for an hour, and we'll have to just have you back for part two, because there's a bunch of questions I didn't even touch on. I'm looking at all my questions here, but this was fantastic. I mean,
I know something that your audience is going to want to hear, and I'm super curious, and I'd love to come back. So you have certain methods that you use when you feel a panic attack coming on. I'm sure that's what everybody wants to know. What's your go-to?
So I go through a system that my audience that listens to me will be quite familiar with, and it's called the NeuroCycle. And what it is was initially developed about 40 years ago. I developed it 40 years ago when I was working with people with traumatic brain injuries, severe trauma, stroke victims, et cetera, et cetera. And at that stage, they didn't believe that the brain could change. But they believed that the mind and brain were separate. So in the 80s, when I was first studying, that was what I was trained in my neurology and neuroscience lectures. And I challenged this and did research, did some of the first neuroplasticity research in the world, and fast forward, I developed a theory and an application of how does stuff get in our brain. So when you went to Gaza, when you did everything that you're doing, as you have this conversation, life, how does life get into us via our mind and get stored in the mind-brain-body network? And how does that impact every cell of our body? And how does that over time create vulnerability? Which just goes to a point I wanted to point out that you actually started talking about, which was how the panic attack does become a burden on society if we don't deal with it. Because over time, your body wears down. And so each panic attack unmanaged is wearing your body down and increasing vulnerability to illness, which then impacts productivity, workplace, health, costs, insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So there is that long-term thing. So what I wanted to do was to try and understand, how does it, if something gets in, if it's good, how do I make it get bigger and better so I increase my resilience? Or if it's and bad, how do I reverse engineer? Knowing that I can never get rid of my story, but I can reconceptualize my story. You can't change what's happened, but you can change what it looks like in the mind, brain, body, network. Literally, the networks in the brain, the networks in the body, and the network, the gravitational fields of the mind. And so that's what I developed. Based on that philosophy, I developed a system called the NeuroCycle. So it's an app, the mental health technology platform, and it does a lot of different things, but it's panic attacks are one of the things that you can use it for. So it's basically kind of what you're probably already doing, but it is an in the moment, you can use it in the moment and then over time. So what you've done unconsciously is when you're asleep. What you've done non-consciously, non is the active form of our intelligence that is driving us. Unconscious is when we're asleep. So the word unconscious is used incorrectly all the time. Okay, so your non-conscious knows what you need to survive and how to turn that panic attack around. So what we need to do is our messy mind, which is in that conscious state in the moment, is drawing on a pattern that has also been built into the non-conscious by our life experiences. So let's go back to your experience as a 12-year-old when your dad died. You would have developed a network from that mind, brain, body experience. You experienced that through you, your mind, and it went into you and became part of you forever. And you developed a coping mechanism. So that got wired in. And as you went through life, you practiced. And within 63 days, that's some of the work I've done, you would have built a habit. Habits take at least 63 days to form. Now, each time you practice that multiple cycles of 63, your networks got really strong. It's in a forest of trees. It's a big, gigantic tree that is driving your functioning. So what you did, and non-consciously, you used what I've used consciously, is you pretty much, as you've done this journey, what caught my attention so much about what you said, which I started off in the beginning, was that you said you had to get to that well and that source and find out that that was the source. And there was the acceptance that you can't ever change the fact that you're going to always grieve your father. But you had to work out how can you reconceptualize so that you can change how it plays out into your future. In other words, how you can stand in front of the camera and do what it is that you do so very well. So it was that source, finding the source, and then accepting and then reconceptualizing. And that's what the NeuroCycle does. It's a 5-step process that basically takes you through that. So you use it, like if you're creating a habit, you would do it daily for around 15 minutes a day between, and then sort of as you move on into the last 42 days, it's about 5 minutes a day. But you can also use it in the moment of a panic attack where you can actually train yourself. You can bring in the holotropic breathing, or you can bring in, you know, it's like a 30-second of each step, and you can get into a rhythm, and you can practice that so much that as you go into a panic attack, you could be looking at the camera and exactly. In 10 seconds or 5 seconds, you could run through a NeuroCycle and it'll get you back on track again. So that's kind of, that's a quick run through, and I didn't want to take away from what you're doing.
I do something similar.
You've literally done it. Exactly. You've been doing it.
I love that.
Yeah. Then we can chat about it more. And I can send you my app and you can try it out and you'll see the steps there and that kind of thing. So in terms of your story, in terms of, let me see here, I'm going to jump to the final question. But we have to have you back again, because there's so many great things that the way that you explained, like Reiki and your ayahuasca experiences, and just, I loved how you, for example, said that what worked for some people didn't work for you, and what worked for you didn't work for other people. And that's what's so key, because even with psychedelics and things, it's being touted as the next thing. We're in a society that's always looking for something external to put on the internal, to fix the internal. And what impressed me about what you've done, and how you speak about this and you write about this, is that you used everything, but at the end of the day, you realized that it was you had to retrain and rewire and be empowered.
Exactly.
And your Gaza story, what really got me. So you got
there. That's exactly what it is. You hit the nail on the head. And for me, the psychedelics work because I needed to get, I said this earlier, but it's a concept I think about all the time. I needed to get out of my right mind in order to do this work. And then once you do it a few times, you change the habit, and then you're able to do it in your right mind. I don't have to be
mushrooms
to go to that place and feel emotion like crying. That's
so beautiful. When you said that, it's fantastic. You've got it in you, and you use whatever to get, and you use the breathing, you use ayahuasca, you use the Reiki. The Reiki experience, the way you described how you were lying on there and the stuff was pouring out of your nose and your you were sobbing and you described the sobbing and all that stuff. I mean, that was your experience, but you got there and now you can get there without having to go through that. And that is, that's the power that we have in us. That's what I try and teach all the time. That's what I do with my life's work too. That's why I'm so excited to interview you, because you just represent, we didn't even know each other till now, but I feel like I know you because you represent what I get so excited, because you represent what I know we can achieve as humans. And how we can get through and become decent humans. So connect, you know, your story of connecting to others in when the whole Gaza Israeli thing, that terrible Hamas thing happened, you know, that story, that the security guard, you know, that shows that when you as a person grow like that, that humanity came out in you, that love, that whatever. So, I mean, without waxing lyrical, that's kind of, I want to thank you for that, because you're teaching that. Any final words, Matt, or anything you want to say about what I said there? You know, I forget the question. Let's just, let me hand it over to you. Just how would you wrap up this part one?
I think that everybody likes, and you know, one of the things that we talked about and that I love about your philosophy that you agree with me is like, there is no easy fix, right? That I don't have all the solutions. I have modalities that work for me and I'm still working on it. And this is my one of my life's works, but I do have a quick, I don't say trick, but it's a mindfulness technique that I use if I feel panic coming on. All right. And it's super easy. It's used all the time.
Wonderful.
And it's, you look around you. And again, you just talked about it and it's like, you're reading my mind. You can do it while you're staring at the camera.
I do read minds. I read minds. No, I'm just teasing you.
But yeah, you can do it while you're standing in front of the camera in my case, or if you're in the line at the bank or wherever you are. So I focus on five things that I see. All right. And I isolate them. I see the door outside, my dog snoozing on the couch, my other dog on the floor with the ball, which is blue, and the monitor in front of me, whatever it is, five things. And then you think about five things you hear. Okay. I isolate the sounds. There's bird chirping. I hear you, Dr. Leaf. I hear a lawnmower outside and a leaf blower from the gardeners, right? So four. Then three things that you feel. I feel the shirt on my body. I feel the headphones in my ears. I feel the insoles in my shoes. Two things you smell, and then one thing you taste. And so if you go through those 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 senses, forces your mind to think about something other than the panic or the possible threat that you're feeling. And almost invariably, it helps to get me out of that mindset and just knocks me off that track enough. Exactly. To like sort of essentially avert a panic or an anxiety experience. So for me, that's beautiful. A really good method. Again, nothing is foolproof. Nothing is perfect, but it's a nice little method. And even if it doesn't work, you've just done about 95 seconds or 2.5 minutes of mindfulness, which is never a bad thing.
So good. Exactly. You have another thing as well that you talk about, which I loved as well, with the string. And feeling the string with the knot.
But it's a little more conspicuous. String or a pencil.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, the beads. The beads. Oh, that's a good one.
Yes. Yeah, the beads.
Which is similar. That's also, so that's just like a counting. That's five deep breaths going down. There's also like if you hold a pencil in front of you and then you focus, this apparently messes with your vagus nerve. And so you focus on the pen and then you focus on something beyond it, and then you come back and do that a few times. But that's a little bit more conspicuous, holding a pen and changing your gaze.
Yes. The other one, you can just do it without even.
Exactly. Anyway, so those are a couple of
Matt, thank you so much. I'm so glad you shared. No, those are fantastic. And they're so helpful. And that's something people can use immediately. And thank you so much. It's been amazing. And I look forward to part two. I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com and to sign up for my weekly newsletter, where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline Lee. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guest. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for educational and informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional for any individual medical questions you may have. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors.